Isaiah 5, 1 through 7. It's called the Song of the Vineyard. But as a sort of background for this, I'd like you to look at 2 Samuel 12. Second Samuel 12, and the sort of why does a prophet use a story? Why does prophet use fiction? What's the advantage of telling of telling a tale?
And before you met them.
Why?
What?
Sometimes it has a great deal more impact, but why? Why do stories work?
Well, they're concrete, rather than abstract, I would say.
They dramatize a situation, they make it very, very explicit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can get the point across in that way when you can't any other.
You can simplify the details and make a sharper, a more sharply delineated interpretation.
Visual pictures.
Yeah. Now the prophetic tradition, in the prophetic tradition we have not only the use of images, but actually the use of some little plots, and one of the first examples of this is in 2 Samuel. I think myself that when Jesus starts telling parables, that he is in this same tradition of using the form of story as a way of altering a person's perspective. I guess I'd make one other comment. I think a story can draw you into looking at something from a angle that you don't want to look at it from. In other words, the interesting thing about this Nathan story is that the king, David, is drawn into passing a judgment on something that he would only very slowly pass on himself. So that you are drawn in a story. You've got nothing to lose if you pass judgment on a story. And so one of the great accomplishments in storytelling was that the prophets and we can see this in the Song of the Vineyard, the audience, the listeners, agreed to the criteria of judgment before it got around to them. And so they were in the position where they had to draw conclusions about themselves that they had already drawn. So that there is a way, I'll put it very simply, there is a way in which a story can get under your skin in which a sermon could never. And so the Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said to him, there were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he brought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children, and it used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his bosom. It was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him, but he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger was kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. And Nathan said to David, you're the man. And That's interesting, yes. By the by, that's pretty interesting because we all remember David's sin as adultery. And because of our culture's preoccupation with sexual unfaithfulness, it's interesting that in David's time, what Nathan put David on the spot for was economic exploitation. David had lots of wives, and he tampered with a man who had only one wife. So that Nathan was much more troubled by the economic aspects of the sin. And then in another text, there's the other thing that bothered them is that David was basically unfaithful to the trust relationship between Uriah. Uriah was one of the army, and David is the commander in chief. So David is exploiting a relationship of trust. And it's interesting how the senses of which sins are more sinful sort of shift from culture to culture. Although I might... What?
He took a life, too.
Right, right. He arranged that that Uriah would be fairly vulnerable. But maybe one definition of a prophet is that he's one of the measure of a good prophet is that he tells the people in authority the things that they don't want to hear. And I suspect myself that in the years ahead, we will have much more conflict over economic sins than we will over other sorts of the crunch of economic structures. And if it is true that there will be as increasing disparity between those who are in economically prosperous situations and those who are not, then it looks like this kind of area will be a very sensitive one, and one in which I suspect it is much easier for us as Lutherans to argue about pure doctrine than about economic exploitation. And sometimes I'm tempted, not always, but sometimes I think we ought to debate doctrine, but sometimes I think that's a good way of avoiding talking about some other things. Okay, let's get on to another, a similar use of parable by the prophet Isaiah, which is in Isaiah 5. Now again, by attending to the poetry, just one other bit of background. The form of parable is part of the repertoire of the literature and the preachers. The other important thing is that this is the topic of this vineyard bit is a very ordinary topic. I mean, this is like writing about wheat farming or sheep farming in Montana and wheat in Nebraska and so on. You know, it's to have as the topic of the story, the vineyard, the cultivation of the vineyard is not to have an unusual topic, but to have a very ordinary topic. It's to talk about something that was familiar and something that was as natural to some of the leaders of Israel as child rearing or a sense of the wilderness. So it's a very common kind of topic. Would you note again, my concern is to find the voices in this story, and I think you can very easily discover three different voices. So that in fact you have a little skit in 5:1-6, and you have an interpretation, a sort of epilogue or curtain call in verse 7. Now, clearly the, in verse 1, let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. Somebody's singing a folk ballad, so that the first voice you hear, the first figure on stage, is someone who introduces the ballad. And then the second voice, and now, O inhabitants of Judah, Jerusalem, and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. So the second voice is the voice of the one who has been called beloved in verse 1, the person who is the owner of the vineyard. First you have the ballad singer. Second you have the person that the ballad is about. And there are two stanzas, verses 3 and 4, in which the owner of the vineyard is pleading his case as a lawyer before the people of Jerusalem. Am I right to do this? And then in verse 5 and 6, the owner of the vineyard is passing judgment on the vineyard and telling what he or she will do about it. And then in verse 7, up until verse 6, there is no word practically, but almost no word that makes it anything else but a story. So, if you are going to get the impact of this piece, you must try to hear it as really a story about a vineyard. You know, we miss, by interpreting a parable too quickly, we miss the great dramatic revelation scene. And the dramatic revelation scene is in verse 7. It's in verse 7 that all of a sudden what was a story about taking care of your farm becomes a story about Israel and Yahweh. And because we know how the story is going to come out, we tend to read the story, and it's something like reading a mystery story when you know the ending. You know, there is something interesting about this, but you just water down completely the sense of surprise. So I'd like you to think ecology, think taking care. What are you going to do with a piece of land that doesn't harvest properly? And think about this man being in a civil court and having a case about whether it's right to cultivate or not cultivate this land. Is the cultivation of the land a profitable thing? And if the land doesn't produce, should he let it go back to its original state? One more theme to notice. So we will postpone, try to separate yourself from verse 7. One more thing to notice is the wilderness logic. There's obviously a judgment exercised by the man against his land. Now, what is the character of that judgment? The character of the judgment is to withdraw his care of the land. The land was wilderness. He took it from wilderness to cultivation. The cultivated land produced the fruit of the wilderness, and so he will withdraw his care, and it will go back to being a wilderness. I'm afraid that one of the things that concerns me about from where we come from is that too often Yahweh looks very arbitrary. But in his own time and place, Yahweh looked far more just and fair than the arbitrariness of Zeus or Marduk or the gods around. So that they are hearing this not as a, well, he's going to give up already, but my goodness, he spent a lot of time taking care of that. And isn't that, that's a very reasonable thing to do when you sow your wheat and care for the farm and it produces wild rye, then you quit taking care of it. Let it be as wilderness. So that you have here a ballad, a rather sad ballad, a ballad about trying to turn a wilderness into a garden, and it doesn't turn into a garden. So notice the proportionate character of the judgment. An eye for an eye. A withdrawal of cultivation. If the cultivation doesn't change the harvest, then there's no point in cultivating. There's one more thing I want you to notice, and that's that the economy with which the prophet poet creates his effect of the sense of the land. He does it with one word. In verse 2b, and he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. One word. And I can remember, you know, how when I see something like that, I think of how long it has taken me in some sermons to make a point. And I sort of groan a little bit. Let's see. Betsy, would you and Jean read two voices? I want three voices.
I have a living Bible. You may not want to switch.
It doesn't make too much difference. The sentences come out about the same, so that it doesn't make any difference. Betsy, would you start in and read verses 1 and 2, and then Jean 3 and 4 and 5 and 6?
I will sing for my beloved my love song about his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard high up on a fertile hillside. He trenched it and cleared it of stones and planted it with red vines. He built a watchtower in the middle and then hewed out a wine press in it. He looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes.
And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedges, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its walls, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it.
Okay. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a cry. The statement as I hear it in this text is again a very plaintive, persuasive st- statement of the voice of Yahweh and the concern of Yahweh. Yahweh has cared, has expected, has been disappointed, and has, in a sense, withdrawn, or is ready to withdraw. And so the telling of this story, the telling of the story of the disappointment of Yahweh, telling of the story of the disappointment of Yahweh, of the melancholy, of the pathos of Yahweh, is the description, so to speak, of Yahweh's heart in the matter, becomes then the prophet's final plea to the people of Judah to deal responsibly with what they have been given and to deal with the expectations of covenant and of land, so that the as I hear it, the impact of this piece is not so much an idea, but it is the representation of this compassion, if you want to call it, if that's one way of talking about it, if you get the old sense of compassion, passion with someone, compassion as a entering into a great intimacy, into a great sympathy with a folk. So that the Song of the Vineyard then ends with the prophet in this kind of peace, picturing a hearty, compassionate provider as the context in which Israel has to make its decisions about Judah has to make their decisions about their land, their foreign relations, their domestic integrity, their kings, and their whole lifestyle. I'm interested in what these are fairly sad oracles. Chapter 1 was they're not sad in one way, to find undergirding of existence, find existence undergirded by being and Yahweh is not a sad thing. But to find Yahweh, to discover that Judah was a wilderness and a disappointment and a prodigal is a fairly melancholy awareness. What of this kind of wrestling with Israel do you think places claims on us now? These are old poems, you know. This is 8th century BC. So we're talking about close to 3,000 years time between us and these folk. And how do you see this this compassion and this disappointment translating into our scene? Where do you think that these pieces land in terms of
seems to me if we think about who the prophet was speaking to, then it comes very close to us who are in the church. He was speaking to the religious people, the people that knew God, the Jews, and not to anyone else necessarily. And we in the church are the religious people today, the ones who know God. We're having some similar problems, and I think you can almost make a direct application in some cases, because just as in Isaiah's day not everyone had gone away from God, it was certainly applicable to many, and here today the majority, and sometimes I wonder if that's not true today in the church as we define it.
Do you think that the poem is about the church?
That's a good question. Yes, I think so. My gut response is that, but then I have a whole bunch of ifs and ands and buts in there.
I'd like, if you want to state some of the buts, or somebody else want to state some of the buts, I think there is a crossroads in interpretation that hinges on whether you take this as being addressed to the church or addressed to the nation. Are we to read this oracle as being about the Christian community or about America? Or are we to read it as both?
But at the time that it was written, there was no distinction, was there?
That's right.
That's the part of the problem.
That's part of the problem. Their society is not differentiated in the same way that ours is, and you don't really have Judaism as a religious community until after the exile, and this is a good 150 years before the exile, so that you have a people. And although one thing to correct about their situation, most of us have the idea that the Jews are all very pious and they all know God. And it probably isn't the case. The Jews are fairly syncretistic. You read the books of Samuel, you read Kings, for example, and you find about two or three of the kings pleased the Lord, and the rest of them didn't. And you figure this is all, there are four major prophets, really, and 12 minor ones, and this is the gleanings of sermons for about 300 years, and that's not such an awful lot in 300 years, so maybe there weren't so many good preachers either. So that don't over romanticize the religious condition of Israel as a country. But it is true that the covenant was with the country. The covenant is to Israel like the Constitution is to America.
I guess that's where I have a problem with the nation. And with the church today, when we think of the church, if you can define it, as splintered as we are, as divisive as we are, as competitive as we are, then I see real parallels between Israel, the nation, the church at that time, and what we would call the church today, and not necessarily the nation, because there are lots of problems in the way we define church, and it doesn't always fit together. And then I can see that Isaiah is speaking to the whole church, all the people who go blithely along saying, "I'm a part of the church."
Well, when do you read this as an intention of Yahweh to abandon the church because it does not bear fruit? That maybe Yahweh will find it seems to me to confront these texts, we have to confront what I think is best understood as the freedom of God.
And I don't like to do that. But
The classical reformers were really more worried about the freedom of God than the freedom of man. If God was free, then certainly man had some potential freedom. If God wasn't free, then man is in bondage, however much he talks about freedom. So that the freedom and sovereignty of God for both Luther and Calvin is absolutely essential to maintaining an open universe, to maintaining an open universe and an accountable society. So that essentially, judgment is a very dramatic and very hard way, firm illustration of the freedom of Yahweh. And literally, Isaiah is saying to Judah, you don't produce, Yahweh's not, you're not going to be special anymore. So that read in terms of the church, this means, you don't bear fruit, well, maybe Yahweh will have to bring forth Christ in another form and give the word of Christ to another people. So that and this is fairly radical. I don't think it was any easier for a devout Jew to think of Yahweh as in some sense withdrawing Torah or withdrawing temple than it would be for us to think of God taking Christ away from the church and simply allowing the church to be pious and religious and syncretistic and maybe have Christ born all over again, someplace else.
Well, what you're talking about is a possibility, but I don't see any reason to suppose that's going to happen because of what is written in Isaiah.
Okay, then what? This, if you think this applies to the church, then there is.
Maybe it applies to the nation. You
know? Maybe it does apply to the nation. Maybe it doesn't apply at all.
Yeah,
maybe it doesn't apply at all.
Maybe it only applies to Judah.
You're right. Maybe it does. This is why I'm in a sense.
But if you look at the various catastrophes, they generally in the Old Testament they happened to nations, and were the result of the nation as a whole's conduct being mostly unsatisfactory. I think that the non-Christian element of this. Of the United States could possibly drag the whole country into a catastrophe. Christians weren't really responsible for.
So you can see some possibilities that Yahweh would give up on America. And in fact.
But not necessarily on the Christians.
Okay.
But there's a lot of going on in America that isn't very Christian.
And that's an interesting idea, though, that if he's willing to give up on America, and in fact, see, the covenant implied a leadership in the creation of a community of order and justice. One of the passages we skipped, which is a later passage, but you may want to look at it, and we'll run into some more passages next week like it in Isaiah 2. He shall judge between the nations, they shall beat their swords into plowshares, spears into... Nations shall not lift up sword against nation. So that the commission of the covenant people is really to exemplify peace and justice. And so that it is conceivable that that task would be given to another country. To another people. This is what I hear you dealing with Luther.
I guess I have a lot of trouble with that. You've used the words judgment and abandonment, and I don't think the two are I think the two are mutually exclusive. I don't hear God abandoning his people, but I do hear him judging them. abandonment, the nation was restored. Granted, after some time to pass, God, by really did abide by his original covenant with his people, that he would not abandon them. I don't know if it's a really good analogy, but I was just thinking of our garden this spring. We had a rather large section of our garden where we had planted carrots, and the weeds just inundated that whole thing. And we judged the dickens out of that section of the garden. But we haven't abandoned the garden. We planted and reseeded. I don't hear God abandoning his people.
No, I wasn't trying to say if the country went down the tube, God wouldn't look after his people in the process, but we would lose a lot. I mean, a lot of what we have would disappear in the way of material things, I'm sure. If our country was conquered and devastated by some foreign power. We'd lose a lot, but I'm sure God would still look after his own people in ways that were the really essential ways that he knows now.
Okay, and I guess that's where I pick up on it, because I agree that God will look after his people, but at the same time, he will also allow us to suffer the consequences of our sinfulness. And we might very well bring about or at least some very severe punishment. But I don't think he's going to abandon us.
I don't find, as far as this particular piece goes, where this piece ends, I don't find anything else but an indication of withdrawal. There are other pieces, like the Isaiah 1, where the purification is a preparation for reformation and restoration. But in this piece, there is no mention internal to what the prophet is saying on this day and in this place. There is no mention of the long-term intentions of God. And if we are to deal with the radical freedom of Yahweh, okay? If we are to deal with the radical freedom of Yahweh, it seems to me we do have to deal with the possibility that Yahweh has a will for the human species, and that he will cultivate, that he can select, and he can select over here, and he can select over here, and that we do not live in a claim on Yahweh. We live in a situation of grace rather than claim. And it just may be, if Yahweh is serious about his will, that he will move more freely than either we as a country or we as a church expect. Okay, this is sort of the beginning of a long conversation. Tomorrow you'll, the problem for tomorrow is what sense you make of Romans 6:10, where the prophet is more or less commanded to tell the people not to understand.
Romans 6:10?
No, Isaiah. Isaiah, I don't move that fast. So let me just read the piece once more. Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He digged it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it. and he hewed out a wine vat in it. Got all ready for harvest. He hewed out a wine vat in it, and he looked for it to yield grapes. But it yielded wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it? I've really done everything that I could do. When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I'll tell you what I'll do with my vineyard. I'll remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I'll break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. And I'll make it a waste, and it shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. And I'll also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed, for righteousness, but behold, a cry. So be it.